Exactly, we can get us started.
Which I so I'm going to talk about if Neil lets me. So I'm going to talk about some astrophysical constraints that particular can be used, well, constraint models with some of the enhancements. Doug talked about in the morning about CMB constraints, and Jennifer has talked about extragalactic gamma ray backgrounds. So some of the results you have seen before, but I would like to go in detail on some of them. So let me start with giving an outline of my talk. So first I will just briefly give a motivation. Well, you have seen essentially the excess of positrons measured by Pamela, and a description of the Sommerfeld enhancement, very very brief. And I will talk about the Rolle density constraints, which is probably the one that you haven't heard about. Then just quickly CMB constraints, and I spend most of my talk talking about the extragalactic gamma ray background and how can it be used to constrain the model. So you, of course, you are very familiar with this plot. So the case for dark matter annihilation to explain this possible primary source of positrons, as Jennifer was saying, you need a large cross-section. So large, and well, we have heard a lot about these boost factors. So I'm just going to say briefly, these boost factors are measured over the standard value, for those of you who don't know, but the standard value that you get from the usual thermal relic value that gives you the right amount of dark matter. And you also need, of course, the suppression of annihilation, the channel of annihilation into protons and antiprotons, because Pamela also doesn't measure that excess. And, well, a very nice idea to get this kind of larger boost over the standard scenario is through the Sommerfeld mechanism. And you can also, of course, suppress this channel if the mass of the new force carrier that you need to create this mechanism is less than 2 times the mass of the protons, then you don't have this problem either. So just to give you a very quick idea how this works, I will just take a very simple case where the annihilating particles are interacting through a Yukawa potential. Then you can solve the problem in the non-relativistic case. You take the Schrödinger equation, you plot there the potential, and you can see how the Sommerfeld enhancement is, which is essentially just the boost of the cross-section, which is the ratio of the amplitudes of the wave function in the perturbed case, so when you have this potential, attractive potential between the particles, and the unperturbed case. And you can solve this analytically in the case of a Coulomb, in the Coulomb case, so the force carrier goes, the mass goes to zero. And then you can see this is how S, or this boost factor of the cross-section, goes. So beta is the relative velocity between the particles. So it goes, you can see that if the coupling is large compared to the velocity, then this boost goes as 1 over B, which is the traditional way people know about this, the simplest way of this enhancement. But of course, if you want to really solve the Yukawa case, so when the mass is different than zero, you can do this numerically. There's a way to approximate the potential, actually, to get an analytical solution. But if you solve this numerically, for example, it has been done many times, but this is a work by Latanzi and Silk in 2009 in the plot. So you see the Sommerfeld boost as a function of the mass of the dark matter particle. The different colors of the lines are different relative velocities. So you see that for very large velocities, you essentially have no enhancement. And then there are some, as you increase the velocity, the enhancement grows, and there are some regions that are these resonances, which can be understood, or at least I understand them as just, if you go to very low velocity here, you can actually expand the potential in the exponential that is here, and then you can see that this equation looks like the hydrogen atom. So then you can see this, the existence of these bound states. And these bound states are actually related to a very very significant increase in the Sommerfeld enhancement. So anyway, close to resonances, you can have, as I was saying before, very very significant increase. And of course, at some point, this was all done, in principle, in this equation, exactly on top of the resonances, the enhancement will go to infinity. But in reality, there is finite lifetime associated to this bound state, so the enhancement is saturated. So let me then go through how this can have an impact on the relic density, as someone was asking early in the morning. It was actually something that was neglected at first because, of course, in the early universe, the velocities are very high, and then you expect the Sommerfeld enhancement to be low, very insignificant. So that's why at first people thought that it would not affect the relic density. But when you actually do the calculation, of course, in some cases, the Sommerfeld enhancement can actually be already high at the early universe. So, but what you do is you take the Boltzmann equation. So here you have the evolution of the number density of dark matter. You have expansion of the universe, annihilation of particles, and creation of particles if the universe is hot enough. And the only change for the standard case, where you usually introduce a change of variable, just instead of time, you have temperature. And the only change goes, of course, here with the cross section, which is actually an average over the velocity distribution of particles. In this case, since we are always, or most of the time, in a non-relativistic case, this is just Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution function. So you plug it in there and you solve this equation. And just to remind you, these two behaviors that go for the Sommerfeld enhancement to go at 1 over b or 1 over b squared, when you do this average, they just translate into 1 over sigma, which is the velocity dispersion, or 1 over sigma b squared. And of course, what you want to do is just use this equation, solve it for a particular model, and then see if when you match the solution of this equation to the actual observed abundance of dark matter, if you can get some constraints for this model. So this is just the standard value. And of course, there is an important time here, because when you have chemical decoupling, so that's the annihilation and creation of particles is keeping the thermal equilibrium. But after that, you have chemical decoupling that ceases to happen. But still, there's a scattering between the dark matter and the ordinary particles, and that keeps equilibrium still. But after that, actually, there's no longer equilibrium between dark matter species and the surrounding plasma. And essentially, the temperature of the WIMPs, of the dark matter particles, decays faster than, it goes colder than radiation. So that has a significant impact in this calculation, because then you will get velocity dispersions that are very, you will get cold very, very fast, and you can have a huge boost to the enhancement. So this is more or less how it looks like, just schematically. This is just, you can think of just the usual commoving number density plot as a function of time, or the inverse of the temperature. The case where there is no enhancement, this is a traditional case. So at the beginning, it follows the equilibrium solution. Then it freezes out, and the commoving number density remains constant. Of course, once you have this effect of the Sommerfeld enhancement, you get this increase in the annihilation rate. And then it can suppress the number density of dark matter. And in principle, this suppression goes all the way down if there is no, it continues until today if there is no saturation. And of course, this is just the kinetic decoupling temperature, the earlier it happens, the colder the dark matter fluid will get, and the more extreme will be this effect. So of course kinetic decoupling is a very important part to get significant constraints or not. So this so then you can answer, you can try to answer the question, if I want the right abundance of dark matter today, what do I need to do? Then you need to decrease, because you are in this scenario, you need to decrease the normalization of the cross section or the value it has without this boost. And that limits the kind of boost factors that you can have today. And this is what is shown in this plot for this Yukawa parameter space. So this is the mass of the new force carrier. This is the coupling constant. And these lines that you see here, more or less highlighted, those are the ones that correspond to the resonances. And from this plot, that this is something that we did, the paper was published last year, we get something like the boost factor shouldn't be, let's say, in the regions of interest, they shouldn't be much higher than 100 or so, because they are in conflict with the relic density constraints. There are other analyses that have come since that day, and they find essentially something similar. No? So, for example, I think in this case it's something like 300 or so, the value of the boost factor. Of course, there are ways to go outside that. Maybe Tracy will talk about when you talk about models that don't follow this simple. If when you have multiple state dark matter, for example, you can go a little bit higher. But the point to take in mind is just that there is an effect on the relic density, and that it can be significant, and that any model should pass this constraint.
I'm a sigma squared. That's only close to a resonance, right?
Yes.
So unless you're direct at a resonance, you have actually just a logarithmic enhancement, isn't it?
That's right.
Yeah, so it's not that big of a...
Actually, here it's not. That case is not here, not the
one
over
b squared.
It's not here.
So you think that's the logarithmic?
Yes, sir. Okay. It just can be very, depending on the kinetic decoupling temperature, it can be. That's right. So actually, of course, you get the stronger constraints that are close to the resonances.
This could be a very logic on the resonances.
Yes.
Yeah.
But off-resonance, if the kinetic decoupling temperature is low, then off-resonance usually most of the effect just comes from the fact that the sum of Fermi enhancement can still be a factor of 1.3 or 1.4 at 3 sound. So you need to take that into account. Mm-hmm. And if the kinetic decoupling temperature is low, if the kinetic decoupling temperature is higher, then these later annihilations become more important. And on resonance, they become very important.
So in this plot, there is no saturation there. In true, any realistic model will have saturation at some level as well. Right? Otherwise, in this kind of picture that I described, in the Yukawa case, as I said before, in principle, in the resonance, you go to infinity. There is nothing to stop you in that particular moment. So I will just go very, very fast through this part. I mean, Doug already explained how it's very important to consider the CMB constraints on the power spectrum. I just wanted to mention quickly that you also actually have an effect on the energy spectrum as well of the cosmic microwave background. Because of this energy injection, if it happens at certain redshifts, for example, between 10 to the 4 and 10 to the 6, you actually create a distortion on the black body, on the pure black body spectrum of the CMB, which is of the type of, for example, this new distortion, also this Y-type distortion created by this energy injection. If you just show an example of this, of the constraints on the values of mu, but of course mu is not very strongly constrained by current observations. For example, COBE has this constraint on mu, so overall, comparing this constraint to the CMB constraints or even the relic density constraints, a very weak constraint. But I just wanted to mention that it's important always to keep in mind that there are other effects that can perturb the CMB. It's not just the power spectrum. So let me dedicate the rest of the talk to give more details about probably one of the strongest constraints that we have today, although, as Doug was saying, it's not as clean as the CMB, but it can give very strong constraints. So this is the background radiation coming from our past light cone. So essentially, this is measured by the specific intensity, which is just an integral over the line of sight of the emission of all these sources that are that have annihilation in them. In this case, for example, dark matter halos. So they annihilate. They produce gamma rays, and these gamma rays propagate towards us and create this diffuse gamma ray background that we can use to constrain these models using, for example, the observation given by Fermi. And this emissivity is just to be, we know about this, but just to be very, very clear, it depends on two parts. So one, which just related how dark matter clusters gravitationally. So this is just gravity, and we think we understand it in the sense of using n-body simulations. Of course, there's uncertainties there, but this is more or less well understood. And of course, there is a particle physics part of the signal, which depends on what your model tells you about the cross section, and also how many photons are produced per annihilation. So how does a typical photon spectrum looks like for one of these models? Well, you have two parts. So one is essentially the photons that are produced, I say here, directly by the annihilation event. What I mean is you produce, for example, quarks and antiquarks. They hadronize, and later you have pions that decay and produce a gamma ray, the continuum, which is this red line here that you see here. You can also have other secondary important effects, like this bump that you see here, which is called internal Bremsstrahlung, which happens whenever you have a charged particle in the final state. And you can also have gamma ray lines of direct annihilation into gammas, or into one gamma and one set boson. At the same time, of course, you produce electrons and positrons. And, of course, these are the ones that are used to fit, for example, the Pamela excess. And when you produce these electrons and positrons, they can interact with the background photons in the universe, especially the CMB photons, and they give energy to them through inverse quantum. And then you produce a secondary population of photons at the lower energies. The higher, of course, they give the energy to the CMB photons. So you can either have them at X-rays or even at gamma rays, depending on the initial energy of the electrons and positrons. So you have these two parts of a typical photon yield. And the specific shape of this, of course, the position of the peaks depends on the model that you are using, and the normalization also depends on the model, et cetera. But these are the two general features that you have. This is just an example of supersymmetry. And this is the part that depends on the rho square dependence of how dark matter clusters. So I just wanted to show these two examples that one was made by the Big Consortium. Mark was involved in this project, and the other one that was already talk about before, but Mike was also involved in the Via Lactea simulation. So these are line of sight projection of this gamma ray luminosity that you expect from our own halo. Of course, the center dominates the signal, but you can have, perhaps if the alpha substructure is close enough, you can have an effect that dominates there. So what I want to say about this is just that to a very good approximation, you can just take to get the total signal that comes from a halo, you can just take the integral over the density profile that you have, and that's actually just depending on global properties of the halo. So this is just like a scaling law. Of course, you have to keep in mind there is uncertainty on the dark matter profile that was said before, the effects of baryons and all that. Of course, more importantly, you have some structure changes the luminosity of halos, in the sense that, of course, halos are not smooth. There is a a very important abundance of some halos, and they are very significant. They contribute significantly to the total annihilation of a given halo. So this is, for example, for the Aquarius halo. You see here the luminosity profile divided by the value at the virial radius of the function of radius. And you see the smooth halo is very concentrated, so most of the signal comes from the very inner parts of the halo. This is just as a comparison, the mass profile, so it's much more concentrated, of course, just because it goes to rho squared. But some halos, because they are tidally disrupted when they enter the host, the halo host, they are, of course, a deficit of subhalos close to the center, and they follow a very different luminosity profile. But the important part is that they can contribute here. For example, this goes all the way down to the resolution of the simulation, where in this case it's something like 10 to the 5 solar masses for the subhalo that it can resolve. And you can see that at the virial radius, the subhalos contribute as much as the halo itself. Of course, if we expect that the subhalos go all the way down to the hierarchy, going to 10 to the minus 6 solar masses, so all the way down to Earth masses, we can imagine that this will go up and the contribution from substructure will be very significant. But of course, this is very, very uncertain. The biggest uncertainty, I think, in this kind of analysis that I'm presenting is exactly this, no? How substructure affects the signal. So what we did was to take an n-body simulation to simulate this radiation that we expect from all the structures along our past light cone. So we use the Millennium 2 simulation, which is a very high resolution simulation of a cosmological box. So you can just see snapshots at redshift 0 already, and you can see the resolution power of the simulation centered in a cluster and how you go to smaller scales and you can still resolve many, many structures. So specifically, we create these simulated maps, taking into account the annihilation signal that comes from each of the halos in the simulation, and taking the spatial and distribution from the simulation, and also the temporal evolution. And we added an extrapolation to the sources that we cannot see in the simulation because of its resolution, just by extrapolating the general behavior that we see until the resolution limit. This is, of course, creates, taking into account this uncertainty in how much substructure actually contributes. And, of course, we also included this how Sommerfeld enhancement can goes into this calculation by just going as a function of the velocity expression of a given structure. This is just as an example of how one of these sky maps look like. So it's at a particular energy, 10 giga electron volts, up to redshift 10. Seems very, very smooth. This is more or less to match the angular resolution of Fermi at this energy. It's variable. The first, of course, striking thing is very smooth. There are a couple of structures there. And of course, with these maps, we can do, and we have done many analyses, but I will just talk about one obvious, which is just, you can just take construct these maps at different energies and construct the spectrum to compare it with the observations by Fermi. And this is how it looks like. So again, the specific intensity is a function of energy. So the band is our prediction for a particular SUSY model. In this case, it's just this that is here up. And this band will just reflect this uncertainty in how subhalos contribute to the signal. Of course, this depends on your model, as I mentioned before, on this photon yield. You have cases where this will go up like this, or the bump will be lower or higher, depending on the mass of the dark matter particle, etc. But the point is that these are observations from X-rays to gamma rays from different instruments. The arrows are limits on the contribution of unknown sources or unaccounted sources. And I will talk specifically about how Fermi, because although the X-rays could potentially constrain some models that will have a large peak here, most of the constraints come from Fermi. For example, these arrows were created assuming that blazars contribute like 16%, which I would argue is close to the lower limit of how much we think blazars should contribute. star-forming galaxies, and here I put a very large contribution we really don't know yet, but I will talk about that in the next plots. So just briefly, let me tell you something nice that I believe is nice that we found. So all of these descriptions that I have given, in principle, for each model that you would like to test, you will have to go through all this procedure to produce these maps and then compare and see if those maps satisfy the constraint of Fermi. But you can actually do something nicer, which is some kind of model-independent way of taking out the part that depends on the particle physics out of the integral that goes into the specific intensity. Of course, it comes to a price because you don't know exactly. I mean, you can always do this, but you have to choose a particular value of the redshift that depends on your model, so you don't know this redshift a priori. But the nice thing about the integrand in this equation and the signal in general is that actually the halos that contribute the most to the signal are very close to us, so very low redshift. You can see this in this plot. I mean, forget about the lines, just concentrate on the black one here. So this is the value of the integrand that goes here inside for the specific intensity as a function of redshift, and you can see this is very flat. So essentially all redshifts are contributing the same to this integral. But of course, on top of that, you have your photon spectrum. And that photon spectrum decays very rapidly with energy. And because of redshift, so the photon that you are being measured today comes from, if you measure it at 10 giga electron volts, for example, if it was produced at redshift of 1, then actually it has an energy which is 2 times that, right, because of the redshift effect here. And the actual, this part that depends on the spectrum decays very rapidly with energy, so essentially you are getting most of the signal from very low redshifts. So I'm saying all this because then you can limit the redshift in this integral, and then the price you pay for taking it out, for the uncertainty of taking it out, is very low compared to the other uncertainty. And because you have taken it out of the integral, then you can just directly just produce one map for one particular model that you want, and then you can compare it with whichever model you want. This is an example of how it works. So this is a direct constraint on this wind part of the signal, so this the cross section, the photon spectrum as a function of energy. So the gray bands, this gray band is for the case of minimum extrapolation of from results of halos, and for the maximum extrapolation of results of halos. So whichever model, you don't have to go through the whole process that I just discussed. You can just take this plot and plot your favorite model here directly in this plot and see if it satisfies the constraints or not.
The optical depths, there seems to be two totally different models that we choose.
Yes, so here we actually took Gilmore et al. Yeah, or Stecker et al. This is just how they actually model the absorption. I'm not sure what are the details, but they can vary a lot. I mean, of course, for Fermi, we are always, most of the case, especially where the constraints are strongest, are around 10 giga electron volts or even lower. So this is not really very, very significant. And again, of course, the stronger the absorption, then your photons will come from even lower redshifts.
But is it clear if one of the models is better than the other one, Gilmore or Stecker?
I think Gilmore is a revision of what Stecker has done, but I don't know if there's a clear reason why one should be better than the other one. They're just competitive models, something like that. Yeah.
Sorry, I missed something. So where is the Sommerfeld enhancement in that formula?
Yeah, I mean, it's actually here inside. Why is here inside? Because actually, when you look at the contribution from Sommerfeld enhancement, of course, it comes from the very small structures which give the higher boost, right?
Yeah.
So essentially, you can almost forget about the big ones and take the ones that come from the smaller structures, and those are already saturated. So the Sommerfeld enhancement is effectively a constant, almost a constant. Of course, if you want, this is of course very rough. If you wanted something more specific related to more detailed comparison, you would have to put it there, right? But to give you an order of magnitude, it's 5. And because you have this big uncertainty on the subscalar contribution, then it's 5.
And to be honest, unless your force carrier mass is really, really small, or your subhalo is cut off at quite large numbers, I suspect approximating it as saturated is much better than an order of magnitude approximation. This could possibly.
So what we did was to play this game with one of the some of the models that satisfy all these previous constraints and feed the Pamela data very, very nicely. So these are again models where there is a mass splitting, so there is two states, one excited and one is not excited. These are the kind of mass splitting that we have, the kind of boost factors that are allowed, so you see that some are even higher than the ones that I was talking about when I talk about the relic density constraint, because they have checked that this is actually consistent with them. They are consistent with the CMB constraints and with all other previous constraints. And we went and checked if these were satisfying the constraints from the extragalactic background. And this is what we find. So this is the plot that shows it says minimum here, but it's actually the maximum value of this particle physics part of the signal that you need to get the data. So this is essentially puts a maximum limit on what you need to get the data divided by the value of the model. So anything below 1 is in principle ruled out in this plot. These are the different models, so these six benchmark models.
Yeah, sorry, this is, it doesn't say, but this is energy.
Energy,
yes. Okay. So, I mean, this of course comes
from, very quickly to see where it comes from. It comes from these guys here. And again, this is assuming a minimum contribution from subhalos, of course, in principle, maximum should get worse, but Tracy is gonna talk about that. But so here I have used a contribution from star-forming galaxy of 53%, which is probably high. Contribution, I mean, for energy is larger than 1 GeV. For blazars, 60%, which, as I was saying before, is probably lower limit on how blazars should contribute. And you can see that all of the models are ruled out in this sense again. But of course, a lot of it could be because I'm probably putting the contribution of star-forming galaxies too large. I don't know, right? It could be too large or not. So that's what I have explored. We have explored here, which is you can translate these things in constraints directly on what's the maximum value that you can get for the cross section as a function of the contribution from star-forming galaxies, keeping the blazars constant at 16%. And you will see that I was using something close to here. But as I take it almost to the level of 0, I will have values more or less in this, close to this order of magnitude, 10 to the minus 23. But here in these arrows, small arrows here, are the values that you need to fit the Pamela data. So they are always lower than this. So even if you assume that the star-forming galaxies don't contribute at all, you still don't get all of these models, we still fail, let's say, in the sense that they will not be able to fit at the same time the Pamela data and satisfy all these constraints. Of course, I will like to end with some caveats about this. So one is that we assume the minimum mass for bound halos, so this extrapolation that I was talking about, to be 10 to the minus 6 solar masses. But in these models that I'm exploring here, actually, kinetic decoupling can happen quite late, and that means that your minimum mass for bound halos is not 10 to the minus 6, but it could be something like 0.1 solar masses or so. So that decreases your signal. We have estimated that this is more or less like a factor of 2, so perhaps it doesn't solve completely the problem. Yeah, I'm finishing now. It doesn't solve the problem, but of course it weakens the constraint. I will just finish with these 2 points. So one of the most important ones, I think, is that the simulations that were done and used to produce these maps, they don't include the fact that these models, actually this, that the dark matter particles can interact with themselves through self-scattering. So that could reduce the density costs of the dark matter halos, in that essentially reducing the annihilation signal. And well, the second part, I guess, is going to be Tracy's talk on how you can weaken these constraints by taking into account the local substructure boost to explain the Pamela postulates. Thank you.
So, can you? So, I guess so. Tracy, are you going to talk about this local substructure?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
I'll be talking about that right after the coffee break.
So then, I guess you had already plenty of questions during your talk. So, let's thank Jesus again.